Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And I'm James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, and we both welcome you back to another important episode of The New World Next Week, which, of course, you can find everything you need at NewWorldNextWeek.com. High quality, low quality audio, video, the show notes, everything you need is all at NewWorldNextWeek.com. James, we'll begin with a story that, even as I was prepping the segment, have further developments, and they are developing as I come to you here early morning, October 10th here in the States, and we'll grab it from antiwar.com. Obama swaps black sites for justice at sea. Over the past 12 years, captives disappeared off the streets of foreign cities have regularly found themselves in CIA black sites, held incommunicado for indefinite periods of time for enhanced interrogation. President Obama harshly criticized this policy at one point, but this last weekend's capture of Abu Anas al-Libi has set up a distinction without a difference, as he is being held in a similar circumstance at sea. Libby's, that's L-I-B-Y, Libby's capture by U.S. ground troops sparked an immediate rebuke from the Libyan government, and the Obama administration is now holding Libby on the USS San Antonio, an amphibious warship, and they are arguing that it can more or less keep him there as long as it likes, and since it's in international waters, it's outside the pesky U.S. justice system. Officials say that Libby has not been Mirandized and is facing open-ended interrogation on the ship without access to a lawyer, with officials saying they intend to bring him up for charges at some unspecified point in the future at some unknown venue. Until then, if then ever comes, he remains in the same legal limbo as many other U.S. detainees, with the ship just being the latest excuse to avoid an actual trial. So, James, will also include the more mainstreamy take from the Associated Press, putting it in the form of a question: did Obama swap black detention sites for ships? And as I noted, as I was prepping this story, James, just in the last couple of hours, gunmen seize Libyan prime minister in a raid. Those are the headlines right now. Libyan prime minister kidnapped at gunpoint. And James, I will turn it over to you with that.
Well, that is a pretty big developing story. But as you say, it is developing as we're recording here. And as we're talking, I'm due to be on RT in about 1 hour to talk more about that. So hopefully that will be already up by the time you get this version of New World Next Week. But we should talk a little bit more about the person who was actually kidnapped here. Of course, there's much to say about the idea of the detention sites and the fact that Obama is just continuing the Bush policies of extraordinary rendition, but just doing it in a slightly different way to conform to his promises to do this and that. I think we can all see through the transparent lies that are coming from the Prince of Lies, or should that be the Prince of Peace, Obama Peace Prize laureate. But beyond that, looking at this specific character, this al-Libi who was captured in this raid, it is a fascinating and twisted tale, and for more on this, I'm going to direct people over to Tom Secker's site, investigatingtheterror.com, where he's got a very interesting article about the history of this particular character in the Al-Qaeda drama, and just reading through this, it is absolutely fascinating. This man, of course, part of the LIFG, which was part of the MI6-sponsored assassination attempt on Gaddafi back in 1996 that has since been whistleblown by MI5 whistleblowers, and that caused a huge kerfuffle when that came out. The LIFG ended up leaving Libya and going to London, where they operated freely and published their newsletter from an office in London and were walking around as free people. And from that position, apparently this al-Libi helped in the planning and plotting the 1998 African embassy bombings. He was later put on the FBI wanted list, and he is still listed as wanted on the FBI wanted list for the 1998 African embassy bombings, even as he continued living openly and freely in the UK. And then he ended up getting captured in January or February or March of 2002 in Sudan or Afghanistan or Somalia, depending on what report you read from what source. And even in 2006, the Amnesty International were saying that there was some evidence that he had been part of the Bush's extraordinary rendition program and was in detention already. So this is another one of those shadowy al-Qaeda figures who has not only been openly operating in the UK despite being on international wanted lists, and who has been captured multiple times, if we buy the stories coming from the MSM, supposedly they've just recaptured him on the streets of Tripoli. This stinks to high heaven. This is another one of those characters that have been drawn up in this drama, and it's interesting to see that the entire war on terror narrative is being rejuvenated right now with all of this al-Shabaab nonsense, and now this al-Libi raid, and now the gunmen in Tripoli. So maybe NATO should go back in again and bomb the country again, this time to get the very guys that they helped put in power. It's getting more and more ridiculous. So this is a developing story. We will continue pounding on this one, because I think this is going to explode into an entire new kettle of fish, as it were, to mix my metaphors.
It just, honestly, James, as you were talking, it makes me think of, you know, Oswald handing out hands-off Cuba flyers on the street corner in order to cause a big scene. So, yeah, it's always layer upon layer upon layer in the shady game of cloak and dagger. But again, you can see the big headlines on the mainstream sort of news 24/7 channels, and they'll never give you the context. So James, I'm looking forward to you fleshing this out even more on RT. So having said that, we'll move to our second story, and it's a bit of a shift, and we'll grab this one from TheVerge.com. 23andMe receives patent to create designer babies, denies plans to do so. Since 2009, the Google-connected 23andMe has offered a service called the Inheritance Calculator, which lets parents see the odds that their future child will inherit a selection of traits from brown hair to lactose intolerance. This latest patent, which the company applied for in 2008, covers the technology that comprises this calculator, but it also goes several steps further by describing a system that would allow parents to select their preferences for a host of traits, some of them medical, I want a kid with a long lifespan, others maybe not so medical, I want a kid with blue eyes. The system, according to this patent, could be used to, quote, identify a preferred donor among the plurality of donors, end quote, based on genetic information. So, of course, genetic analysis to check for serious inheritable diseases already happens, but the kind of non-medical trait selection that 23andMe is talking about is extremely controversial and is already illegal in Canada and the United Kingdom. According to the company, however, they won't actually be implementing the system described by this patent. Quote, at the time 23andMe filed the patent, there was a consideration that the technology could have potential applications for fertility clinics. The company never pursued the concepts discussed in the patent beyond our family traits inheritance calculator, nor do we have any plans to do so, end quote. And even if they did, it might not yield the same results that parents are looking for. The genetic foundations of traits like hair color or athleticism are markedly more complex than researchers had surmised several years ago, meaning that anyone trying to design a baby might be sorely disappointed with the end result. James, you are a new father, and your baby was naturally born. You didn't get to pick any of the traits, did you?
No, and it absolutely just, again, this is another one of those things that's being rolled out as just a wonderful thing. Why would anyone reject this technology? Why eschew the natural processes that humans have been going on, undergoing for since the beginning of humanity? No, now we have to start designing our babies. Well, for people who aren't creeped out by that type of technological development, I suggest you check your assumptions and check your head to what headspace you're living in, because this is the beginning of the truly Orwellian future that we're already starting to live in. But let's pick up on a very specific part of this article. You said the Google connected 23andMe. I hope we don't have time to outline it, but I hope people will check into the Google connections to 23andMe and then check into this very related story also from The Verge, which came out actually just yesterday. Google reportedly investing hundreds of millions into new life extension company Calico. So Google is now starting a life extension company that is working on technologies that will help you extend your life. Yes, I'm sure it's all for your benefit. What on earth is going on with Google investing in all of these biotech companies and starting spending literally $250 million or more on life extension? Well, it has to do, obviously, with the fact that Ray Kurzweil is now a Googler. He's now one of the Google's chief executives. And who's Ray Kurzweil? Of course, the man of the transhumanist movement, and the one who's obsessed with living forever. He wants to live forever and eventually transfer his consciousness into robots and all of this craziness. So this goes right into the heart of transhumanism, and unfortunately we don't have the time to really flesh out the critique of transhumanism here, but for people who are interested, I really hope that you'll check out my previous work on this subject, because it is a fascinating and terrifying concept that is being indoctrinated in the general public right now. And if they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on companies to do this type of work, imagine how much they're investing in the propaganda that's aimed at making you want to embrace this technology.
I would only add, James, you called it Orwellian. I think it's actually much more Huxleyan in a way, because this kind of designer babies in test tubes is precisely what's talked about in his warning, Brave New World.
Correction gladly taken. And again, I hope people will take a look at some of the debate about the Orwellian future versus the Huxleyan future. And I think Huxley's is, in fact, even more nightmarish when you really look at it.
But it's so happy and smiley on the face of it. James, having said that, we will now move to our third and final story this week. And it comes from the always important allgov.com, and of course tweets out at Media Monarchy on Twitter. Shutdown in the U.S. If you haven't heard, our government is allegedly shut down here. Shutdown ends food inspections in the U.S., leaving 90% of U.S. seafood imports unchecked. For consumers, the federal government shutdown amounts to eating certain foods like chicken and fish at your own risk. With about half of the workforce at the Food and Drug Administration on furlough, 91% of seafood imported into the United States is not being inspected, according to media reports. Nearly 50% of fruits and 20% of vegetables imported and consumed in the U.S. also aren't undergoing inspection. Quote, FDA will be unable to support the majority of its food safety, nutrition, and cosmetic activities, reads a Health and Human Services memo detailing a contingency plan in the case of a government funding stoppage. FDA will also have to cease safety activities such as routine establishment inspections, some compliance, and yada, yada, yada. Caroline Smith DeWall, food safety director at the Center for Science and the Public Interest, a nonprofit consumer advocacy group based in Washington, told the Christian Science Monitor that the FDA normally inspects about 80 food processing facilities a day, and that work is conducted in partnership with state agencies, which will continue their work during the federal shutdown. But DeWall adds, it is unclear how long the states can continue without federal oversight and the funding that FDA provides to these agencies to cover their costs. On Tuesday, a salmonella outbreak linked to raw chicken and Foster Farms facilities has sickened 278-plus people and counting in 18 states, landing 42% of them in the hospital. And we close, James, by noting that Caroline Smith DeWall told the USA Today, quote, this outbreak shows that it is a terrible time for government public health officials to be locked out of their offices and labs and for government websites to go dark. James, the government isn't watching over us. We're all going to lose it and we're all going to get salmonella and die, right?
That's exactly what they want you to take away from this. Oh, we need the government. We need government services or we're all going to die. The FDA loves you, and the FDA has never approved things that have gone wrong before. They've never approved bad things before, right? The FDA loves you so much. If anything comes out of this shutdown, I sincerely hope it's the idea that people will start to turn to other ways of ensuring the quality of their food. Imagine if an independent agency came along to try to actually validate the work that the FDA is supposed to be doing and actually approve and put their label to something. Imagine if that happened, and if it was an independently owned and operated, if it was a private version of this, then if they made a mistake, guess what? They'd be out of business the next day. If the FDA makes a mistake, they get more money. I wonder which system is ultimately better for assuring the safety of people. Oh, I just can't imagine. Now, I really hope that the shutdown starts to bring out some of that type of ideas in the public. And the idea that we do not need mommy or daddy government. In fact, mommy and daddy government is in many cases making us sick, not preventing us from becoming sick. But I don't think somehow that's the narrative that's going to get played out.
So, James, I would just argue that a lot of this food you maybe don't really need in the first place, that you should be looking more local and in season for your foods. And that, you know, It's a moot point. So, James, shifting this and flipping it, as we always try and do, to a more positive bent, putting it in your own yard, so to speak. This weekend, here in Portland, Oregon, the folks that brought you May's March Against Monsanto, and that would be my amazing girlfriend, Cassie Cohn, and also her co-organizer, Tiffany Ayers. This Saturday, October 12th, is actually World Food Day. So here in Portland, they are putting on actually a solutions-based event called the Bees and Seeds Festival. So we'll include links to beesandseedspdx.com as well as an interview on a local non-commercial station here leading up to it. And so I'm going to be there at the event. I'll probably do a bit of interviews and things, so people keep an eye out on Media Monarchy, as well as using not only hashtag New World Next Week to submit stories, but also hashtag Food World Order. And on that note, I'll also be interviewing Keith McHenry, who is the co-founder of Foods Not Bombs. I'm going to be talking to him Friday, and I'll hope to have that interview up lickety-split as quickly as I can, because Food Not Bombs is doing an event this Sunday. Like the terrorists that they are, they give away food. And apparently that's a huge, huge problem to the man. So stay tuned for more on that, James.
Well, when all goodness has to flow from the teats of government, then anyone who's jeopardizing that monopoly has to be crushed down, so no surprises there. All right, on a deprogramming note, just before we end today, I should mention that I do have family visiting from Canada for the duration of October from today, so that means that there's going to be less content coming out from CorbettReport.com over the next few weeks. All of the regular videos and podcasts, etc., should be coming out as usual, I hope. There might be a Questions for Corbett instead of a podcast episode next week, and the like, but I hope that generally the regular videos and podcasts will be out on time, but any extras and interviews and the like are going to be basically very small, if non-existent, over the next few weeks, so I hope people will bear with me for that, and but I hope we'll be here at least next week, continuing on with New World next week.
Absolutely, my friend, I appreciate it.
All right, take care.